Well, I think that everybody here tonight probably is quite aware of the fact that the war in Iraq, which now is in its fourth year, and today there's a major article in the LA Times that I was reading just before I came here about the injuries, the wounds that are, you know, hidden from us. So we can't see that the fact that while the death toll relatively is at a lower, much lower level in relation to injuries than was the case in Vietnam, the numbers of horrific injuries, of lifelong disabling injuries, of brain injuries, blindness, loss of limbs, and so forth, is actually very high. And many of the people who come back with these kind of injuries are facing very dire circumstances, not only as a result of their wounds, but as a result of their economic situation. And this is something that's just completely, been almost completely hidden from the public here. That's a consequence of a war, as I was starting to say, that I think everyone is quite aware of, was a war based entirely on false pretenses. And just to underline that point, there was an article in the New York Times on the 27th of March. But it talks about a memo describing a two-hour-long conversation between President Bush and British Prime Minister Blair that took place in January of 2003, about 6 weeks or 7 weeks before the war started. David Manning, Mr. Blair's chief foreign policy advisor, wrote in the memo, "Our diplomatic strategy had to be arranged around military planning." This is also a kind of a reiteration of what was in the Downing Street memo, that recording the meeting that had taken place in July of 2002, saying basically the same thing. The intelligence is being fixed around the determination to go to war. And they talked about several different things in that meeting. They said that the U.S. was thinking of flying a U-2 reconnaissance aircraft with fighter cover over Iraq painted in U.N. colors, and hoping that the Iraqis would shoot at it and then could be declared in breach. Or that the U.S. might be able to bring out a defector who could give a public presentation about Saddam's weapons of mass destruction, which, of course, didn't exist, so this would have been another complete falsification. Or they could perhaps assassinate Saddam Hussein. And this is all what was going on leading up to the war that was not based on any intelligence failure. That would be a completely misleading idea. But instead, more the idea that this Manning advisor, the guy, the advisor to Blair, said that the intelligence is being fixed around the military planning, around the objective of going to war, which in fact we know had been an objective of U.S. policy from the first meeting of the National Security Council under Bush in late January of 2001. But in fact, goes back to the Clinton administration, and I want to come back to that a little bit later and to say that in 1997, in the fall of 1997, President Clinton signed the so-called Iraq Liberation Act, appointing a man named Frank Ricardoni as the transition advisor and declaring for the first time that the official U.S. policy in Iraq was regime change. So all of what has transpired, all that we have seen over the last 3 years, is the outcome of a war that was sold to the people based entirely on lies and deception. And the war has, of course, gone very badly, and this is no secret. But as the war has gone very badly, and as it has gotten worse and worse and seemingly more and more intractable, the U.S. government has apparently, the top leadership, decided to take the advice of that great man of wit and wisdom, our Secretary of, quote, defense, unquote, Donald Rumsfeld, who said a few years ago that sometimes when you have a problem that you cannot solve, the answer is to enlarge it. Now, this is not something that most people apply to their personal lives. It's not, gee, I got a problem, I wish I could make it bigger or worse or something like that. But it's very interesting that he would say this, and Rumsfeld, despite making, you know, many kind of statements that get him into trouble, and then you don't hear from him for a while, and then, you know, he'll be gone for a few months out of the media, and then he'll come back again. But his point is really is a guide to what is going on right now, and how it's a kind of a window into how the Washington policymakers look at the Middle East and look at their problem in Iraq, and what they see as a possible outcome that could be favorable to them, and that possible favorable outcome could be based on enlarging and extending and increasing their aggressiveness in the region. And that's really what the topic of my talk is about, is that what are they really doing at the time as they seem to be sinking into this intractable quagmire in Iraq? Instead of looking for a way to withdraw, they are looking for a way to expand the conflict. And they also, and I think this is very important from the point of view of organizations like ours, which have been one of the major anti-war coalitions, organized many, many, virtually all of the mass demonstrations in San Francisco and Los Angeles and Washington, and sometimes in partnership with other organizations. But I think it's a very important issue, not just from an academic, of course, or theoretical point of view, but from a point of view of what does our movement that we're trying to build, how does it understand what is really going on here? And this has become an issue where there's one side which is saying, well, let's just talk about Iraq. Let's just focus on Iraq because the people are becoming unhappy with Iraq. And if we just focus on Iraq, we can somehow rally more forces and perhaps affect the congressional elections that are coming up and so forth. And let's not talk about those other issues, particularly in the Middle East, which are going to more alienate people. And the view of the Answer Coalition has been that that's a really unrealistic approach to the situation and does not provide a foundational grounding for the movement that we're trying to build, which is a long-term project from our point of view, not a short-term one, a long-term project that has to be grounded in an understanding of what the real objectives, strategy, and tactics of our, I would say, enemy, that is the government of the United States, which I believe is not really our government, but really constitutes more of the biggest threat to the people of the world, including the people of the United States right now, to understand what is it that they are trying to do, and what are they trying to do in the Middle East, and how is it related to their global strategy, and in fact, how is it related to their strategy here as well. I went to Syria in December, and I'd like to talk a little about some of the specific elements or specific countries and how they figure into this strategy. I went there in December at the invitation of an organization called Ayadun, which means the returners in Arabic or something like that. And it was a conference about the Palestinians who are in exile, spread around in different countries in the Middle East. And often the issue, and particularly by U.S. officials, the issue of the Palestinians in exile is treated as if, oh, that's something we can't deal with, impossible, don't bring it up, it'll just mess up the peace negotiations. But you go to the Middle East, and the reality is that there's about 1.6 million Palestinians in Jordan, 400 to 450,000 in Lebanon, a similar number in Syria, similar 1.7 million who are living in the West Bank and Gaza, who come from other parts of Palestine. And we're talking about the people who were driven out in 1948 and then some in 67, and their descendants, and there are 4.2 million Palestinian refugees who are registered with UNRWA, the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, that has responsibility for providing health, education, and so forth for them, housing. There are probably another million at least. So half of all the Palestinians in the world are living in exile at the very least. So I went for this conference, and I was there to talk about the issue of Palestine in the United States and the anti-war movement. But what I really was very interesting was I got into Damascus about 3 in the morning. It's a 24-hour long trip to get there, and not direct ways to go. And by the time I got up, and it was the morning of December 11th, there was a huge crisis that was going on in the country. And the crisis was going on because a Lebanese politician had been blown up that morning. His name was Gibran Tweni. And he was a member of the parliament and a publisher of a right-wing newspaper there. And immediately, by the time I got up at 10 or 11 o'clock in the morning, and what I could make out of the news was that Condoleezza Rice and McClellan from the White House were both pointing the finger at Syria and saying it must be Syria that did it, and we warned Syria. They have to stop interfering in the affairs of Lebanon and so on and so forth. Well, it was very interesting, and it was all the news in the country for the next couple of days and throughout the Middle East. But it's very interesting because it was on that day that United Nations Security Council was to come forward with the second part of a report about an earlier assassination of a Lebanese politician whose name was Rafiq Hariri, who was killed by a bomb, a huge bomb, in February, on February 14th of 2005. Now, it would really test the credibility, the credulousness of anyone to imagine that the Syrian government, which was the target of the United Nations investigation for the Hariri assassination, on the very day that the second part of the report about that assassination was going to come out, would want to see another Lebanese politician blown up. I mean, that would be, the Syrians denied involvement with the earlier one, but I mean, who could imagine that this would be, I mean, somehow Condoleezza Rice and Scott McClellan knew immediately that it was the Syrians without any investigation taking place. And this created a big crisis. And I should say this, that it was the second part of the UN Security Council report, because the first phase of the report, done by a German diplomat, you may have heard of him, Detlef Melis was his name, had been completely invalidated by the fact that the only two witnesses who didn't have only circumstantial evidence had come forward to say that one had been threatened to get his testimony, and said he had been lying, and the second said he was lying because he had been bribed. So they went back to Melis and said, well, you got anything more? This looks pretty bad. And he said, oh, yes, we got more. We got the second report, and it's coming, which also turned out to be just circumstantial evidence. But the idea that this is what the Syrian government would possibly do was really, you know, almost beyond belief. If you go back to February of 2005, for most people, they would think that's when the situation, the crisis in regard to Syria and the United States began. But in fact, you have to go back to September 2004, and this was something that almost came out of the blue. In September 2004, at the Security Council, the U.S. and France, which just coincidentally happened to be the colonial power in Syria up until World War II, just like Britain was the colonial power in Iraq until 1958 in reality, although it had official independence earlier, it was a phony independence. So the U.S. and France had floated this resolution demanding that all Syrian troops be removed from Lebanon. The U.S. used to be very happy about Syrian troops being in Lebanon, by the way, but that they all had to be removed and the militias had to be disarmed, and those included Palestinian and Lebanese militias, and those Palestinian militias are the only defense that the Palestinian refugee camps that are among the poorest in the world have in Lebanon. But this seemed to come out of the blue, and they barely got through the Security Council. That was in September 2004, and that was the big signal. It was by a vote of 9-0, which is the minimum vote at the Security Council. And that was a signal that was an unmistakable signal that they were coming after Syria, that the U.S. government was coming after Syria at that point. But that wasn't really, so the idea that then Syria 6 months later would be the, do this other assassination that they are accused of by the United States is highly dubious too. But if you go back, you have to go actually back a little bit further to find the beginning of this with Syria. On April 10th, 2003, that is the day after the fall of Baghdad, a man whose name we are many more of us probably familiar with today, John Bolton, said that Iran, North Korea, and Syria should heed the lesson of Iraq. Now, Bolton at the time occupied the position of U.S. Undersecretary of State for Arms Control, a kind of laughable title, actually. I mean, it was arms control of other people we don't like should be added to that title. And the idea that he would, the person, your Undersecretary of State for Arms Control, would be making such threatening statements toward other countries is should be a little bit surprising to people. He made this statement. It was widely quoted in the media. at the time. And the next day, by the way, the U.S. ambassador to the Dominican Republic said that Cuba should heed the lesson of Iraq. And none of our crackerjack media, I mean the corporate media, I'm not talking about the community alternative media, I'm talking about the corporate media, all these people who get paid hundreds of thousands and millions of dollars to toss like puffy softballs at the political figures in the form of questions, you know, none of them said, well, what do you mean, Mr. Bolton? What do you mean by heed the lesson of Iraq? Do you mean that if the Syrian government or the Iranian government or the North Korean government doesn't do what the United States government wants, to bomb them and then subject them to a complete blockade of their country and starve them and cause widespread death, and particularly for the very young and the very old and all people who are chronically or acutely ill with life-threatening conditions. I went to Iraq a couple times during the sanctions. It was unbelievable, the devastation. I mean, imagine in this country, which is the richest country, which has the most diverse resources, manufacturing, agricultural, mineral, everything, technological. Imagine what would happen if tomorrow we picked up the Seattle Post Intelligencer and it says all foreign trade ended. People wouldn't be like looking to see where the stock market was at, because the stock market would have collapsed. Tens of millions of people within weeks would be unemployed. It would be a depression like the 1930s. And that's in a country with the most diverse resources. That's what was done to Iraq. And those sanctions were total for 6 years and then kept in place for an additional 6 years, slightly modified by the oil for food deal. And everybody in Washington knew. Madeleine Albright, I don't know if you remember this, but in May 1995, Madeleine Albright was on 60 Minutes, and she was asked, in May 1996, she was asked by Leslie Stahl of 60 Minutes, 500,000 children dead, more than Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Leslie Stahl had just come back from Iraq and had seen, I mean, almost anyone with the slightest human sentiment could not be help but be like just appalled by what was going on there. And she said to Albright, is it worth the price? And Albright says, well, it's a hard decision for us, but yes, we think it's worth the price. And then goes on to talk about how this blockade and killing all these people in Iraq was protecting our troops in the Gulf. Is that what they meant when he said, is this what he meant? And then to continue on, after we've starved you and caused all this death from hunger and disease for 12 years, if you still don't do what we want, we'll invade your country and we'll end your existence as an independent country. Is that not the worst kind of terrorist threat that could be made? It far exceeds anything that any of those who are called terrorists in the world today could possibly accomplish. They can't do that. And yet this was done. And then after the fall of Baghdad and the end of Iraq's existence as an independent country, which is what was signified by April 9th, 2003, then to go on and threaten that we will do this to you, Iran. We will do this to you, Syria. We will do this to you, North Korea. We will do this to you, Cuba. We will do this to anybody. And I don't know if people remember, but the day after September 11th, Paul Wolfowitz, that great humanitarian who's now helping the poor as president of the World Bank, I'm saying that with the greatest sarcasm in case anyone's missed it, Wolfowitz said some states are going to be ended. And then Wolfowitz disappeared for about 3 or 4 months. They pulled him back. You know, they pulled him out of the media because you weren't supposed to. It caused a big stir, kind of got lost in the September 11th, you know, what was happening on September 11th. The reality is that what he said was what the intention was, and that's what was accomplished. And the dismantling of the Iraqi state was carried out at that time. Now, the great arrogance of the policymakers, who, whether or not they really believed that the Iraqi people would throw flowers and chocolate at the occupying soldiers, as some of them proclaimed, or whether they just believed that there would be no resistance because having beaten down the Iraqi people for all that time, that they would not respond, they would not be able to resist anymore. I think that was more likely what most of them really thought. But they thought in their arrogance, in their great arrogance, that they would be able to create, to destroy one state, one government, one system, and we will give you a better one, one that we have created and create for you. It'll be a much better future for you, but more importantly, it'll be a much better future for those who we represent. So this was the beginning, though, to go back. These were the threats that were made. This was the reality that it was carried out. And these were the threats that were made against the other countries in the Middle East, particularly those that are seen as independent, Syria and Iran. And the argument is presented that somehow those countries constitute a threat to the order in the region. I wish I had a map actually in front of me, because if we look at it, if you look at a map, maps are very useful, and that's why we see them rarely on TV. Particularly, you almost never saw any map of what the proposed peace plan was for Palestine, right? That could never come up with that map. If you look at the map and you look at the situation of Syria, you can see that to the north is Turkey, which is filled, a NATO country filled with U.S. military bases. To its east is Iraq, which is occupied by the United States. To its southwest is Israel, which is the fourth or fifth largest military power in the world. Jordan to the south, which is really under U.S. control. And right off its coast in the Mediterranean is the Sixth Fleet. It's completely surrounded, in fact. Instead of it constituting the threat, I mean, from any objective point of view, it's completely surrounded. And it is a target. There's no question about this. When I was there, one of the things I did was I went to the organizers of the conference, seeing what was happening and seeing how this has been gets played out, how this has been played out a number of times before, and said, you know, if there's anybody here in Syria who would like to have a U.S. peace activist come forward and have a press conference and denounce what the U.S. government is doing and what they're up to, I would be happy to do that. Now, some of the other people who were at the conference with me thought that was a bit risky thing to undertake, but or that I was going to be utilized by Syrian propaganda or something like that. I felt very strongly that we have an obligation, having seen this movie before, to try to step forward and do the small amount that we can. So we had a press conference, and it was very interesting. I thought there would be a few media there. There were 70 or 80 media there, and they were from all over the Middle East, including and also a reporter from National Public Radio who heard about it late, I guess, but she kind of rushed in, and she said, what are you doing here? How did this happen? You know, what's going on? She was just in complete disbelief that this could be going on. And I said and I just want to mention some of the points because I think they're important points to contemplate in regard to the wall of propaganda that comes at us every time a country is targeted, the great wall of propaganda that lets you know that something else is going to happen, but which is really meant to suck in the population and make them just think along certain lines and accept whatever the government is saying. And I said, well, we would have to ask a few questions like, if you were an investigator of a crime and you don't know who has carried out the crime, don't you start with asking who has motive and who has opportunity and who has means to carry it out? And if you were to ask that question in regard to the assassination of Gibran Tweny, probably the last party on the list, and in fact they would not be on the list at all, would be the government of Syria. Yet this is all ignored, while at the same time we know that there are parties in the region who have motive, because they want to intensify this campaign, and have means because they have highly developed intelligence services and technological capability. And those include the French government with its colonial history, the CIA, and the Israeli government, which has a history, by the way, Israel is generally credited with being the originators of the use of the car bomb in Lebanon in the early 1970s, and of the double car bomb as well, carried out by the Mossad, the Israeli Secret Service, which were meant to cause, at a time of social upheaval in the early and mid-70s, the greatest amount of confusion, chaos, terror, death, and so forth. So the double car bomb is the one where the bomb goes off, the people rush out, the buildings have fallen down, they're digging furiously through the rubble, and 15 minutes later, the second car bomb goes off. There's a whole history of this, but none of those were being even considered as possibilities. Secondly, why is it that the UN Security Council has decided that it must use all resources at its disposal to find out who assassinated one political individual named Rafiq Hariri, who was actually not in office, holding any office at the time? We know that, unfortunately, in the world we live in, there are many political assassinations that take place all the time. And one only needs to look at Haiti, since the coup in Haiti on February 29, 2004, where thousands and thousands of people have been murdered for political reasons. But, of course, that is not subject to UN investigation because the UN Security Council is carrying out the occupation of Haiti, really at the behest of the United States. But we would also have to ask a bigger question if we looked at the region. Why all the resources on an investigation of the murder of the death of Rafiq Hariri, and no investigation at all or no hint of investigation at any time coming of the war going on along Syria's border, the war in Iraq, that everybody in the world, as I said at the beginning, now knows was a war based on lies. And where, according to the Lancet magazine, the Lancet journal, the British military journal, considered one of the most respectable in the world, there were 100,000 excessive Iraqi deaths because of the invasion as of October 2004. That's 18 months ago. So why all the focus on what happened to Rafiq Hariri in Lebanon and no focus whatsoever on a war that every thinking person in the world knows was a war that was deliberate, was fought, an invasion that was carried out, an illegal invasion, a war crime, a crime against peace, which is the highest form of war crime, the most serious form of war crime, the form of war crime for which the Nazi war criminals were hung after Nuremberg, that is, launching a war against a country that does not threaten you. How come there is no investigation of that, despite that on the face of it, there is a case for the most serious violations of international law, of U.S. law, of all kinds of law? And I think that the answer to that question is that, you know, why that is not happening is that what happens at the UN Security Council, which I don't think is much of a surprise to anybody anymore, has nothing to do with justice or legality or truth or any of those things. It has purely to do with raw power. And it is the United States government which has the greatest amount of raw power of any country in the world and is able to determine and does determine the agenda of that body and has relegated the broader body at the United Nations, the General Assembly, being almost completely meaningless. I remember thinking that, when we're having the Clinton impeachment hearings, and isn't it funny? I mean, that was so much more serious than the invasion of Iraq, right? When the Clinton impeachment hearings were started, they started the hearings in Congress on the day that the UN General Assembly opened. So that the UN General Assembly session was just like off the, you know, now there's no mention of it, I don't think, almost at all in the media here. And that's what's really happened there at the United Nations. That's a reality of what's going on. And the other point that I raised in the press conference, or one of the other points, was that, you know, really, Lebanon is not the 51st state of the United States. Why are all the top U.S. officials rushing into the country and declaring, we must solve this? It also finally pointed out the methodology of U.S. foreign policy. And this is been replicated now over and over and over again, and that is that the target is selected and then the evidence is collected, or more likely the evidence is fabricated. And in this case, that is what's going on. So this is the situation, and Syria has moved to the back pages of the paper. It's very interesting that Rice is paying a great deal of attention to Syria. She just went to Iraq with Jack Straw, and they were bragging in the media that you know, they stayed overnight in the Green Zone. First time that any type of U.S. officials have done that. They stayed in the Al Rashid Hotel. I know where they stayed. But in the middle of this highly militarized zone, and they're bragging about the fact that they could stay overnight. They didn't just have to fly in and fly out. But she's also been flying into Lebanon. She went to Lebanon about 3 weeks ago, or the end of February. She went into Lebanon unannounced. The Secretary of State of the United States, top diplomatic official of the United States, went in, announced when she got there that she, you know, they told the media she was there, said, well, I'm meeting with the opposition leaders. I will not be meeting with the president of the country because he's too pro-Syrian. It's such a complete insult to any country to do this. I mean, can you imagine this happening? And I won't even be calling him on the phone. And then about 2 weeks ago, the U.S. the State Department, Treasury Department ordered all U.S. banks to discontinue any relationships with Syrian banks. Now, that is a very serious step. That, in fact, constitutes a form of sanctions because of the U.S. economic power in the world. That is a form of sanction without it being called that. But it's an extremely hostile act to take against another country. So this is behind the scenes. This is still going on One Track. The other big target, of course, in the Middle East, and what has been much more in the news, is Iran. The basic argument is that, and it's being presented to the people. I mean, this is not what the government officials think at all, any more than they don't believe any of this. I mean, this is all fabrication. But their argument for the people is, if Iran got nuclear weapons, the whole region could be destabilized. Well, that's why I wish we had the map, because if you were look at the map, if you go to the east of Iran is Pakistan, which has nuclear weapons. And a little bit further east is India, which has nuclear weapons, and which the U.S. just entered into a major nuclear agreement with. And if you go north of Iran is Russia, which has nuclear weapons, and is Tajikistan, I believe it's Tajikistan, which has U.S. military bases, and Afghanistan, which is occupied by the U.S. military. And to the west of Iran is Iraq, which is occupied by the U.S. military. And you go a little bit further west is Israel, which has at least 200 nuclear warheads. And if you go right off the coast in the Persian Gulf are Trident submarines. And I don't know if people here probably know about Trident submarines, right? You're kind of familiar with those. How many cities can they destroy at once? Does anybody know? They're different numbers, but up to 400 with their MIRVs, the cluster of independently targetable nuclear warheads. They are right there, right off the coast of Iran. And we know this. We got a funny, interesting confirmation of it about 3 weeks ago. The Pentagon announced that it was refitting some of the Tridents that were sitting off the Iranian coast in the Gulf with conventional missiles so that they wouldn't, they could use them a step short of nuclear war. But that's a confirmation that they're there, not that it was any great mystery. There's 14 of them. They're the most deadly instrument ever created by humans is the Trident submarine. And no other country has the Trident submarine or anything that compares to the Trident submarine. Just like no other country has a B-52 bomber. I mean, there's quite a few things like that. But Iran is completely surrounded by both nuclear and conventional U.S. military power. And the idea that if it got a nuclear weapon, the region would be destabilized is a little bit ludicrous, to say the least. The real reason, what's really going on here as well is certainly the United States policy is to not allow Iran to get nuclear weapons, not because they think Iran would use a nuclear weapon in some kind of bizarre suicidal first strike. Because what if they had a nuclear bomb, or 5, or 10, or 25, for that matter? Would they launch them? Well, I don't think anyone serious will make the argument that the Iranian leadership, as much as whatever you think about them, that they're insane, that they would like to all be destroyed, and they would like to have their country destroyed, because that's certainly what would happen. The United States has been violating, by the way, they talk a lot about the Non-Proliferation Treaty. They have been regularly violating the Non-Proliferation Treaty by threatening to use nuclear weapons against non-nuclear weapon-holding states. That's considered a war crime under an annex, a 1976 annex to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. What they don't want is to have other countries that are targets have a means of response. But more than that, there's more than that going on here. Any credible nuclear expert, nuclear weapons expert, says Iran could not possibly have a nuclear bomb for 5 to 10 years. And when it gets them, as they say, it's going to be very limited. They might have a deterrent effect if it had them. But the real thing that's going on here is a part and parcel of the Rumsfeld, what you could call the Rumsfeld Doctrine. They may enlarge the problem. That is, to bring down other forces that stand in the way of what the real objectives are of U.S. policy in the Middle East. And there's one other that is very important, very critical, and that is, and not only one more, but one that is extremely critical, and that is the Palestinians, the Palestinian movement. This has been a target for a long time. And this is because, and anyone who's been to the Middle East knows this, is that people all over the Middle East feel the Palestinian issue. They feel this is a great what happened to the Palestinians was a great, great crime. And that the Palestinian resistance movement, and it's not just a crime against the Palestinians, but that it was, it has distorted life and development. This, the intervention and the creation of the State of Israel as what from their point of view is a giant military base. And I think that's the point of view of the United States government as well. I don't think that they act, that they provide $3 to $5 billion a year and all this advanced weaponry because they feel sympathy for Jewish people. Dick Cheney, Nixon, I mean, the whole list of them. I mean, to believe that they feel sympathy with any people, I think sympathy with people and imperialist foreign policy are mutually exclusive categories. These are people who are investors. They don't pour money into, you know, areas that need money or because they sympathize with a particular group or something like that. And from the point of view of people in the Middle East, what happens to the Palestinians and their struggle is seen as being very critical. And over again, there have been these attempts to try to get rid of the Palestinian struggle. And I believe that the Washington group now thought that they were on the brink of being able to sign an agreement that they hoped would bring the whole thing to an end finally. And that's why the United States pushed for the January 25th election to happen. Most of the Palestinians didn't want the election to happen. They were like reticent. They said, it's too fast. It's too soon. You're pushing us. And the U.S. leader said, no, you have to have this election. And what they expected to have happen in the election was that Hamas would do fairly well, but Fatah would win. And immediately afterwards, they would go on a fast track to sign a treaty between Abbas, Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian Authority president who succeeded Yasser Arafat, and Israel, with the United States brokering it. And then they would be able to say, okay, we're giving up on a lot of these other things. The Palestinians will accept a state. It'll be a very strange state. It'll be unlike anybody else's state. They won't have control over their borders, and their territory won't be contiguous, and they won't control their airspace, and they won't control their subsoil rights, and they won't control who comes and goes and what kind of trade goes on, and they won't control their own taxes even. But if they want to call it a state, fine, as long as they just give up the struggle. And that'll be another one out of the way. So this is the idea, I think. This is clearly the Washington policy, to get rid of independent states in the Middle East and to get rid of popular movements that have stood in the way of carrying out these objectives. They also want to get rid of the Hezbollah movement in Lebanon for the same reason. The Hezbollah movement, by the way, is called a terrorist movement here. In Lebanon and all over the Middle East, even the right-wing forces in Lebanon have to pay homage to Hezbollah because Hezbollah got the Israelis out of southern Lebanon, and they're considered the only force in the Arab world that's ever really succeeded in doing this by those kind of means. They want to get rid of them. It has nothing to do, they don't care about their religion. I mean, this is that's the more stuff that's fed to us to justify. Hezbollah has only carried out its activities, as far as anybody knows, or has ever proven, inside Lebanon itself. They want to get rid of them. They want to get rid of the Palestinian movement. They want to get rid of the Iranian government. They want to get rid of the Syrian government. They want to get rid of all of them because they see them all. And, of course, at the center of it, and we can't forget it, is the resistance inside of Iraq, which is constituted, much to their shock, this major force, the resistance movement there, against carrying out what they wanted to do with Iraq. But they still are pushing ahead with the plan. And it's a very, very dangerous group of people who are doing this. I don't think probably that's news to people here. But I don't think we can underestimate what they might do next. And we can wake up one morning and find out some very startling news about this. And I think it's important to be prepared for it and to understand the real context of what's going on with the real objectives. And I just want to mention something. One more thing before kind of wrapping up, and that is about the what's going on inside of Iraq right now. And I wrote this article about the sectarian conflict, and it's very interesting. How many people know who Daniel Pipes is? Pipes is an extreme right-wing analyst. He's got influence in the Bush administration. There's people who go with him. There's people who are against him, but on March 2nd, this is, you know, the there was the mosque bombing in Samarra, the Askariya Mosque, and then followed by a lot of conflict, sectarian conflict, a great escalation of that. And it's very interesting that no one has ever taken credit for that bombing, you know, or responsibility for it. No group has ever said, we did it, which is very unusual for the things that are going on there. So it creates some suspicion. I'm not saying, oh, the U.S. government did it. I'm just saying there has to be suspicion. And particularly if you hear, like, for instance, Pipes, and this is what Pipes told the ABC on March 2nd. I don't think from the point of view of the coalition, meaning the occupation forces, it is necessarily that bad for our interests. In the first place, there would be fewer attacks on our forces in Iraq as they fight each other. Now, the fact was that in the month following the bombing of the mosque, U.S. casualties fell to the lowest level since the invasion, since the beginning, really, the resistance really began. So that turned out to be true, although that probably will not last, and the first few days of April indicate so. And then he says, Pipes goes on to say, expresses hope that the religious conflict would spread. Quote, more broadly outside Iraq, there would be fewer attacks on us as the Shiites and the Sunnis attack each other. So this is, you know, was this the first choice, was to have the conflict? I don't think it was the first choice. The first choice was just pacification. But if you're losing, then the turning to the divide and conquer strategy, and it's not turning to it for the first time. As I had mentioned earlier, in 1998, Clinton signed the Iraq Liberation Act, as it was called, October 1998. And that was the first statement, open statement, although it had been true for a long time before that, that the objective was to get rid of the government, to have regime change in Iraq. And he appointed this guy named Frank Ricciardoni, a longtime diplomat, as the director of quote-unquote transition in Iraq back then. There's also a director of transition for Cuba now. So that's something to always keep in the back of our mind as well. But he was asked by the Turkish newspaper Milliyet in 1999, if U.S. policies were leading to the partition of Iraq, and listen to this, to the partition of Iraq and possibly civil war. And he replied that Iraq, quote, could hardly be considered a unified country today given the no-flight zones over the north and south. And what does that mean? Well, the U.S. had established the U.S., British, and French, and then just the U.S. and British, had all of Iraq in a no-fly zone except between the 33rd and 35th parallel from 1991 up until the invasion of 2003. And what was the objective of that? It was to weaken Iraq's central government control over its own country. And they said so, to weaken its sovereignty, to divide the country. And I think that quite clearly, this alternative has been, this option has been being pursued for quite some time. Now, the U.S. thought that they could create a government and a new government in Iraq, a puppet government that was mainly made up of people from the Shia community and Shia traditional leaders and Kurdish traditional leaders, neither of which I would argue are particularly representative of the people in either region. But that they could do this, and then they found out from the resistance that that wasn't going to be possible, and they've been trying other things. But their least favored alternative is losing. And that's what they have facing, the possibility that they could lose in Iraq. And turning to the strategy of divide and conquer is nothing new. All the great colonial powers have done this. I mean, look at England. England was a country when it was said that the sun never set on the British Empire, and they brutally ruled a large part of the world, and the empire was in India and most of Africa and all over the place. England had a population of about 20 to 25 million people, and it was ruling an empire of 500 million. It could only do that by going into each country and selecting parts of the population to favor and to make the military core and use them against the others and use minorities and to make them completely dependent on the British. It's a time-honored tradition of what's going on. We can see all of these things. And I would say we don't have time to discuss it more, but there are many different tactics and strategy and contingency plans. And if one doesn't work, they go on to another one. But what isn't a contingency plan and what is an overall fixed objective of U.S. foreign policy and has been for a number of years now, not really since Bush came in, and not since Clinton came in or Bush won, but back to the last period of World War II, is domination of global resources. You know, there's a historian named Gabriel Kolko, who some of you may be familiar with, K-O-L-K-O. And he wrote an extremely interesting book that I read a few years ago called The Politics of War. It's a big book, very well researched and documented, about U.S. foreign policy between 1943 and 1945. This is when the war was still going on. And I remember one thing that really stood out for me, that in February 1944, 6 months before the Normandy invasion, or 5 months before, the U.S. State Department sent out to all the U.S. embassies in the world that were functioning a directive that the embassy should help the U.S. petroleum companies in every country where they had a possible interest to get control over more of the petroleum. In the middle of the war is raging, and the determination of the U.S., and this is very interesting when you see all the pictures of the hale and hearty handshakes and so forth on the ships of Roosevelt and Churchill, that one of the things the U.S. was doing in the war was trying to get the oil-producing parts of the British Empire and make sure that after the war they were under U.S. control. So at the same time as they were publicly hugging and shaking hands and meeting on ships and all that, they were stabbing each other in the back. Churchill sent, around that same time, in February 1944, Churchill sent the most sharply worded, angry message ever exchanged with the U.S. government, and said basically this. He says to Roosevelt, "I'm glad to hear you're not making sheep's eyes our oil holdings in Iran," which were really the basis of the British Navy being able to function, "just like we're not looking upon yours in Saudi Arabia. But if you're thinking about doing it, it's going to be over my dead body." I mean, that's basically what this message says. And I haven't changed the wording very much in that. "Not as long as I'm alive," or something like that. In other words, they were very conscious of this. Really, what we know about what was outlined in the National Security Strategy, which became the official foreign policy in September 2002, and which was originally written as a document in 1992, right after, in the first Bush administration, right after the collapse of the Soviet Union, and it was regional planning guidance document in the Defense Department, which said, what do we do now that we don't have the Soviet Union? What should our strategy be? And the answer to the question was, we should be the one sole superpower in the world, and we must create circumstances where no other country even thinks about challenging the supremacy of the United States. And it's very interesting. We tried, I remember this when it came out, and it was in the New York Times, and I think it was something like March 9th, 1992. And the next day, the Bush administration denied it, said, no, that's not the foreign policy. That's just a think document. But clearly, it is the foreign policy. It's what the basis of the Project for a New American Century view is and all of that. It is the foreign policy. We found out eventually who wrote the document. At first, we thought it was Scooter Libby and Paul Wolfowitz. Libby worked under Wolfowitz. But then we found out that the person who actually wrote the document was Zalmay Khalilzad. And for people who don't know who Zalmay Khalilzad is, he is today the U.S. ambassador to Iraq. Or more properly, he should be called the Viceroy or Governor General of Iraq, because he's really the top official in the country. And what does this say? What is their idea about how do you do this? Who are the competitors? Who would compete with the United States for global domination? It's a few. It's a handful, right? A long time people thought Japan would, but Japan, the Japanese ruling class, seems to have, in its majority, accepted the idea of being the kind of Britain of Asia. The junior partner, not the competitor. There's always competition between them, but not competing for supremacy. The others are the European Union and, coming down the road, China. And more, this is what's being talked about, written about. China is the competitor of the future. But if you take all those, there are no other potential ones, I don't think, at this point. But if you look at all of them and you ask the question, what is their Achilles heel? Their Achilles heel is oil. Their Achilles heel is resources. All have what is called energy deficits, and you cannot run modern industrial society in the way it's presently configured without oil. I would argue that what's going on in the Middle East, what we see the strategy designed to do, and what has in fact been happening now for over a period of 25 years or longer, but particularly speeding up in the 1990s, once there's no more Soviet Union, once that world relationship of forces has changed and there's not a major block of power that can compete with the United States, that the aim has been to militarily take control of global oil resources, and that we see this proceeding, that this agenda is proceeding. Can the agenda succeed? That remains to be seen. One of the things that the Bush administration's policy has done is that, and its policies on a number of different fronts, is it's creating a wave of resistance, as well as this extremely dangerous situation, but a great wave of resistance. I don't know if people saw when Bush went to Pakistan for his little visit in Pakistan. He landed in the middle of the night, and this is deliberate, in the middle of the night with the running lights off on the plane and all the shades pulled down. The next day, CNN reported that the country was shut down, but that the demonstrations were smaller than expected because so many of the organizers had been rounded up by the Pakistani military and police ahead of it. They were very kind of cheery about that, you know, forgetting that we're, you know, fighting a war for democracy around the world, you know, just making these statements like that. But the point is that Bush can't really go anywhere in the world today, nor can Rice, without facing major demonstrations. And in fact, there's a rising tide of resistance, I would say, and anger all over the Middle East, but not only all over the Middle East, turn to Latin America as well. This is another area that we have to, I'm not talking about, of course, tonight, but what's going on in Venezuela and Cuba and Bolivia and Ecuador and all over Latin America as the anger against these policies. And I would say, although it might seem to some people as a stretch, that what we see going on in France is connected to this. That the whole globalization and war can't separate them. I don't know if you may remember Thomas Friedman's great column around the time of the uprising here in Seattle, which I was at in 1999, where Friedman said, you know, you can't have McDonald's without McDonnell Douglas, the maker of the F-16, and it's what makes the world safe for U.S. corporations is called the Army, Navy, Marines, and Air Force. Well, that's absolutely true. So we see that not only in the Middle East and not only in Latin America are people rebelling, but people are rebelling in France. They're rebelling very strongly against this idea, and they're being mocked by the media here. Oh, they're not revolutionaries like they were in 1968. I don't know how many people have heard that. They're not radicals like that, as if the media here was hoping that they would be. Oh, they don't have strong enough principles. They're just fighting for the right not to get fired. Well, that's great that they're doing that. I mean, they're saying, why should the world be shaped only for the maximization of profit? That's basically what they're saying. They're being told that they're outmoded, that, you know, they got to get on the train because the train's going to leave them behind, and poor France is not going to be able to keep up with the United States. But they're saying, no, we don't accept this. And 3 million people were out in the streets today in France again. And I think that it's also connected to what's going on in the United States. I was in Los Angeles a week and a half ago at this demonstration of 1 million people. I've been a lot of demonstrations, including the biggest of the Vietnam War demonstrations. I have never seen a demonstration like that in my life. And it was working people. It was working people, and what they were outraged about, it's not like they're, and a lot of the people were undocumented, a lot of the people were not undocumented. I thought one sign that kind of captured it was somebody carrying the sign who said, "We built your house, we grow your food, why do you want to make us criminals?" And I don't know how it is around here, but I know how it is in California. That is the absolute truth. There is no economy without those workers. And they're saying, why should we be treated as criminals? I really think the whole immigration thing comes down to two possibilities for people. One is you can join in the demonization of immigrant workers and, you know, unite with these, But it's not going to mean anything because the world, as long as the capital is free in the world, then there's going to be mass migration. Capitalism has created mass migrations of people. And I read a very interesting thing in a famous pamphlet, and I had never seen it before. It's by a revolutionary named Lenin, who wrote Imperialism, the Highest Stage of Capitalism, in 1916, I think he wrote it. 1916, so that's 90 years ago. In it, he said, makes this interesting point kind of very late in it, and he says, in the early period of capitalism, the migration of people is outward from the metropolitan countries to the colonial countries, just like how the settler population. He said, but once it becomes the monopoly stage of capitalism, the imperialist stage of capitalism, the migration turns around. And the migration is from the colonized countries that the export of capital produces as an inevitable concomitant the immigration of people back in the direction that the capital came from. And I think that's absolutely true. And even more than that is true that immigration is an issue all over the world. Last week I saw a little item saying that in Poland there are 100,000 undocumented Armenians. I mean, Armenia does not border Poland. It's not anywhere close. But the economic situation forces migration from the poorer areas, not just to richer areas, but to slightly less poor areas. And it's going on all over the world, and this is the world we live in. So our choices are this. You can either join in demonizing the immigrants, immigrant workers, which will not stop immigration, and is not meant to stop immigration. And even the most reactionary of these people know that the U.S. economy can't get along without the immigrant workers. They just want to demonize them so that they're more terrorized, more afraid, more exploitable. And if they are more exploitable, then everybody is more exploitable. It goes right up the ladder very quickly. Or you can say, the other alternative is to say, you know what? This is the world. This is the world that we live in. And we stand for equality for all people. There should be equal rights for all people. And people are going to say, well, then more people are going to come. Well, that's going to keep happening. That's the reality. And it's going to keep happening until I believe we have a different system. That's why I write for this magazine, Socialism and Liberation. It's a hint about the other system I think we need. I think that there needs to be a different system. And I think as long as the maximization of profit is what is riding high, it means that things take precedence over people. And I think that's what's going on in France. I think it's what's going on in Iraq. I think it's what's going on in the United States right now. And in many other places that people are rebelling against this. They're saying, why? Why should we have to accept it? Why do we have to accept this militarism? Why do we have to accept that our lives and our futures mean less than the bottom line of these corporations? What has happened? And I think that that's a very good sign for our future. Thanks.